My name is Bill Lennon, and the title of this session is Hating the Sin, Loving the Sinner. I can't even remember what I wrote down. When I was listening to Walt tell us about making an announcement at lunch, I misunderstood him, and so I put together an announcement to draw people to come to hear, which he wanted us to do. But he said, oh, we can't make the announcement. He has to make the announcement. Well, I couldn't have him make the announcement that I was thinking of, so I'll make the announcement now. I was riding along in my car with my children, going skiing. We used to do a lot of skiing when the kids were young, and realized, and due to some of the commotion going on in the back seat, that one of my sons was, really being pretty unkind to my daughter. And I stopped the car and talked about it with them and made clear that whatever he was doing in his boredom and his frustration to his little sister was going to stop, that we were not moving the car until that business stopped. Went skiing that weekend, got back from skiing, and in talking with Kim about that, found out that, there were other little indiscretions that were going on too, like in front of the TV where Big Brother would, as soon as no adults were in the room, he would turn to another channel from what she was watching and so forth and so on. And so that opened up a can of worms, and I got the opportunity and the problem of dealing with some issues that, number one, I wished were not going on in my family, and number two, I didn't know anything about. Well, my idea about this kind of thing is talking about sexual abuse in the church I would just as soon not know that that goes on, but it does. And you can't do much with it if you're not aware of it. I couldn't set any protective guidelines, boundaries, barriers between two kids, which is, of course, a much more minor thing. There were issues going on I didn't know about. So I have a commitment to speak about these kinds of issues in lots of places about sexual abuse in the church and some of the problems with that. This little heading up here, we're not talking about child abuse in this case. That's not what I want to talk about today, although that's an okay topic. I was much more interested in talking about abuse that happens adult to adult. This happened to come from an overhead that we did a workshop at, University Presbyterian Church in Seattle, which I thought also was an interesting kind of thing about getting folks to listen to this particular very difficult and unhappy topic to listen about. University Presbyterian Church had a pastor there that... his name's Bruce Larson. In some circles, he was pretty well known, and he was quite a popular pastor in Seattle. And then he went to, he's currently been at the Crystal Cathedral in California, and he's the other person that preaches if Robert Shuler doesn't preach. And I don't know, he had some level of notoriety, so to get several hundred people to come to the workshop that we did, that particular workshop, they had Bruce Larson come and be the kickoff person, and I thought they really did well. They got 120 people. We were prepared for, 500, but you don't get 500 people to come talk about this kind of problem, even if you bring Bruce Larson in or whoever. But that's all right. I really appreciate those of you that are sitting here on a hot afternoon listening to issues like sexual abuse in the church. I'm really committed to talking about this issue, and appreciate you folks coming. What I want to do today is do some perspective shifting and give you some information, and I have some things on some overheads, and we'll do certainly some question and answer. Some of the perspective shift, and I just wrote it down on my little board over there. One is that when sexual abuse happens anywhere, and particularly in the church, one of the perspectives that I work a lot with people to try to shift is that it's not something out there, it's not in another state, it happens at home. meaning at your own church or in your own city. And so a perspective shift that is a difficult one to get, but that I work hard to help people come to grips with, is that it happens here. It's not out there. The perpetrator is often winsome and charismatic and high-achieving and in a revered position. I'm going to go into some more things about the personality and characteristics of a person that gets into these kinds of problems tomorrow, but if there's an oversimplification of personality type, it's that you have somebody who's monumentally insecure and a great overachiever. But when you have somebody who's monumentally insecure and a great overachiever, they're often the lead pastor, the head football coach, your favorite doctor, your best teacher. You know, they're not people that, at least if you were in Seattle, you'd say live down on First Avenue and wear raincoats and have hair on their teeth. I mean, it's not that kind of situation at all. A couple of books that I will mention to you, and we won't do much with them today, but I'll just mention if you have any interest in that. It's not a new book, but I don't know a better one dealing with that particular issue, is Reverend Marie Fortune's book, and I know they have it here in the bookstore, Is Nothing Sacred? And she talks, has a hypothetical situation of, in that case, a pastor offending a parishioner, and then takes a lot of scriptural, at least from her particular scriptural perspective, as to what steps should be taken to deal about that. Another one is a book by a friend of mine named Mitch Whitman, and they also have that one over there, Challenging the Darkness. And this is a book strictly for people in churches. And although Mitch, in this book, mostly deals with the concepts of sexual abuse against children, the basic ideas are the same, and the steps that you take to what you have to do about that. So he does a nice job of tying that up in that book. Please ask a question if you want to, or certainly what's even more exciting than asking a question is challenging something that I say. That's just fun. Let me just cover a few things here. I've pulled some figures together, and they're from a number of different sources, and so I have a wide range of, if it ever really mattered, I've got all the sources, but 33% to 35% of females in America are sexually assaulted by age 18. That's probably conservative, but we know that, so we can deal with the figures that we know. 5% to 10% of males in America are sexually assaulted by the age of 18. Although we're not going to particularly talk today about children, because I'm talking more about adults, offending adults, still in the society that those two figures happen, it runs pretty rampant. 20% to 30% of female graduate students have been approached sexually by professors. 13% of physicians self-report sexual involvement with their patients. 11% of counselors and therapists admitted sexual contact with their clients. A friend of mine did his PhD dissertation just gathering that particular data, and again, it's kind of hard. Probably 3% to 5% of, and actually pastors are in that one too, 3% to 5% of counselors, pastors, and therapists have sexual genital contact with either their parishioners or their clients or patients. 11% have some kind of sexual contact, although it might be much, it might not be genital contact. 1 in 10 parish pastors involved in genital contact with parishioners. 400 priests charged with sexual misconduct. And the reason I mentioned that one is the Catholic Church has in a 10-year period of time, I think the figure is $5 billion that they've paid out. I mean, it's just staggering. Settle out of court and that kind of thing. And somewhere, 20 to 25 males have sexual contact with minors. What can I say? I mean, those are frightening and staggering, and there's just an enormous amount of that happening in our society. So the first part, if I have a perspective shift, is that try to get the idea that there's a lot of that happens. How could he do this? Let me say first that when I say he, 8 out of 10 arrests that are made are male. So I talk mostly about males. It's a little bit short of 8, but it's so close to 8 statistically. I would say that it, and we really don't know this, it may be that women don't offend as much, or it may be that they do offend as much, but they do so in a different manner. We don't really know that. I've got some opinions about that. I don't think I'll get into that today. But 8 out of 10 arrests are male. I write this little note to myself because anytime I do a presentation, I try to say, I'm trying to explain behavior. I'm never trying to excuse behavior. There are always choices. You know, people make choices about what to do. And I rarely, I'm a state certified sex offender treater in Washington and have done years and years of work in this area. And I will say to you that I've literally worked with hundreds of pedophiles and sex offenders, and probably working with 4 pastors right now, 1 priest, 2 or 3 doctors. I mean, I work with lots and lots of people in this area. I don't know that I've ever worked with anybody that hasn't been sexually abused themselves. I don't know that I ever have. On the other hand, that for every person that's been sexually abused and then abuses, there may be 100 that have been sexually abused that don't abuse. So I'm not trying to explain it away. People make choices about what they do, and we try to not excuse it, but get a sense. A precipitating factor may be having been abused, a person having been abused himself. But just understand that a lot of people who get abused don't engage in that kind of behavior. Power imbalance is what the issue is, and that's crucial to get. It's another perception shift that I like people to try to get. Let me see if I can say this well, and if I can't, I hope you'll challenge me to understand it, or maybe you wouldn't even like it. The issue is not so much what happens to someone. That's bad enough. Bree and I do a lot of work together. Bree's sitting on my left. And a person that we have a lot of respect for is a woman named Jan Heineman in Jackson County, Oregon. Jan Heineman will say, and I say the same thing, I just give her the credit, that when someone who's been sexually assaulted, either by their pastor taking 6 months to groom them and set them up for some kind of sexual contact, or whatever it is, she always hopes it's violent. Because if it's violent, there's very little question that you know that that person's the jerk. And you can get over short-term trauma much better than you can the other piece that I'm talking about with the power imbalance, which is when a person is your pastor or your doctor or your stepdad or your uncle or your big brother or your best friend's husband, you often put them in a position where you don't have a computer chip for them crossing a sexual boundary. That's the real difficulty with sexual abuse. You don't know what to do with that. You have a perception that your pastor would not cross that line. And if and when he does, that can be so devastating to you psychologically. Because you don't have any, there's nothing in there to work with that. Does that make sense to you? It really is probably one of the key issues, if not the key issue in doing victim work, is trying to help people figure out something that you can't figure out because it doesn't really compute.
Bill, would it be fair to say that the pastor to an adult would be a parent-child
kind of role
to where it's that he would never do that to me,
sure.
Like my dad would never do that to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we do that to pastors in that we make them a little closer to God than we are, and we distance them because we want them to be somewhat perfect. And a lot of pastors do that to us, too, try to build some distance. So, yeah, I think it could well be almost like a parental figure. And you may think, oh, I don't really do that. I'm on the church council, and we're buddies. But sometimes we, if not them, then your doctor or someone who you put in that kind of revered position. Two women that I worked with, I want to give you an example just to try to make that, get that point across. And these are just, well, they're true stories, but they're metaphors. One was a woman who came to me. She, for want of a better word, because we don't have a diagnostic category like this, was dental phobic, and what would happen when she would go in the dentist chair was that she would become anuretic and encopretic, which means basically she loses everything. So she would lose bowel control, urinary tract, she'd just go. Well, you can imagine how often she went to the dentist. I mean, she just wasn't about to do that. When she came to see me, she'd not been in a dentist's office in 5 years and was very fearful, mostly fearful to go to a dentist's office, but more fearful, what if I ever have to go to a dentist's office? I mean, that had happened to her too many times, and it was just Well, I worked with her for 19 months, and in that period of time, it became apparent after a while, condensing a whole long-term therapy, that she had been sexually abused, in this case, by her grandfather, and that had happened from the ages of 6 to 13. At age 13, she had told him to stop, and he did, which also creates another problem, which I'm not going to get into today, but she had a lot of guilt to deal with. Well, why didn't I tell him that at 9 or 6, or why did I... So she had to deal with those issues, and that's crazy that she had to deal with it. But a six-year-old doesn't have the wherewithal to figure those things out, so we had to do a lot of work with that. But we did a lot of things, and I have had a lot of follow-up study because that particular woman, I went to a dentist friend of mine and used his office, and we would actually go into the dental chair and do a lot of things. But when she would lay back, she would become in a powerless position, and if she was in a powerless position, it felt to her like being powerless to a male. Well, it happens to be that dentist is a friend of mine, and I still go to him, and so all the dental technicians really think of that, and they'll say to me, oh, Mr. So-and-so is in and she's still doing fine. They didn't know any of that. They just knew here was this lady that could not go in a dentist chair, and here was this psychologist that came along and wasn't it neat, now she can go in a dentist chair. But so they give me feedback every time I go in. Yeah, she's still coming in. It's a great success story. Little did they know. As far as I know, though, it really was a great success story, and a lot of things happened very positively in her life. Okay, cut, end of that story. Another young woman that I worked with, I saw her off and on for a two-year period of time, and more off than on. She was very sporadic in coming in. The sum total of her sexual abuse, to my knowledge, was she was 12 years old and lying asleep in the front seat of her stepdad's pickup, and he was car racing, actually, and had some beer to drink and came back to the car, opened the door, reached his hand inside of her shorts and touched her. She woke up, was startled by this, kicked him in the neck. He backed up, slammed the door, and left. She was absolutely devastated by that. She just, when I worked with her from probably the ages of 19 to 21, she was often suicidal. I can't tell you the number of psychological problems she had stemming from that issue. But this was a person who, she didn't have a computer chip about how in the world he could ever want to cross that line. It just didn't fit. And I'm trying to make the comparison that some people on the receiving end of someone crossing that sexual line don't have the capacity to work that through. And the act that happens is not the issue. The issue is how you receive the move, the advance, the person that comes on to you. That's the issue. And lots of folks, when I go in and work with the church, will say, well, yeah, I know this is bad, but you're going to have a pastor lose his job? Okay, I'm sorry, he squeezed his breast, but give me a break. I mean, there's all kinds of, well, wait a minute, that's not the issue. The issue is what it does to the person on the receiving end and how traumatizing it is. And I don't have a clue to know why one person that I described to you seemed to work through what sounded to me so horrible and so traumatic. And as far as I know, she just did that very well and was very much healed. And the other woman, who had what seemed like much less, was absolutely traumatized. And see, you don't know what goes on in another person's head. So the piece that I like people to try to get is pay more attention to the power imbalance and what that means and what that could cause to someone on the receiving end, and less attention to the juicy, gory details. That makes some sense? Yes?
I just have two comments. I also do counseling with sexually abused teenagers. Huh? But when you said that it was the father or parent figure, and I wanted to finish the rest of your sentence, how could they do that to me if it was wrong? And I think that's the catch that you were saying about, you know, it blurs the boundaries.
If it was wrong, so it must not be wrong, or yeah, they wouldn't have done it to me.
They wouldn't do it to me if it were wrong, and there go the boundaries. And the second point I wanted to make was there's a book.
Thank you.
There's a book called The Forbidden Zone. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
It really is a wonderful book by a psychiatrist who takes all of the professions, the psychiatrists, the doctors, the clergy, whatever, and just goes right through the line on how people in power and prestige could go into the Forbidden Zone. So I just wanted to...
Good, thank you. Forbidden Zone. I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
Good book.
Sounds like I will. Let me, again, in my perspective shifting, if your perspectives aren't shifted, I listed a continuum. Well, it's not really a continuum here, but folks that I work with that, just to give you a quick thumbnail of personality patterns, and I call them sociopathic or narcissistic or obsessive compulsive, addicted, and imprinted. And I just want to make a little quick comment about each one of those. Any and all of those people can cross sexual lines, and any and all of those people can be in any position of power. And can be very, very healthy and positive in other areas of their life. There's a lot of press. Well, I'll go ahead and say this. It's interesting, it's on tape, I'll get myself in trouble. Because I don't know some of these folks. But if I were to make a diagnostic statement, I would say that Jimmy Swaggart, a charismatic pastor, was probably more sociopathic. And I would say that John Kennedy was probably more obsessively compulsive around his sexual behavior. Does that make any difference? And I would not work with Jimmy Swaggart. I don't know how to work with him. I'll give you a statement or two about that. I don't know how to work with a person like that. They're just too far out for me. I could have worked with John Kennedy because I think he had numerous redeeming qualities and he was compulsive about his sexual behavior. Does that make some sense? And if he'd wanted to work on that, I think that was a very workable kind of issue. I have enormous high regard for 12-step programs. Everybody that's court-ordered into the program I work with has to be involved in a 12-step program. Has to be. If you get court-ordered to where we work, you have to do it. It's interesting that Pat Carnes, who's been a real leader in the field of working with obsessive compulsive sexual behavior and addictive behavior, in talking with Bill W., who started the 12-step, or Alcoholics Anonymous, he was clearly a sex addict and didn't ever deal with that. They didn't know anything about sex addiction at that time. And in Pat Carnes talking with his wife, she said, I wish we'd have known that, because that's a fairly new kind of thing. It doesn't mean that they're bad human beings. I'm mentioning people that I think have offered great, wonderful things in our society, but in certain areas have had very, very gray boundaries about what they can, you know, and the damage they can do in that area, but still do great things in other areas. The sociopathic person or the antisocial personality person, to me, is a person that I don't personally work with, because I'll tell you, there's at least if nothing else, there's such a low empathic position that what they will do is, if they get caught, what they'll cry about is because they got caught. They don't cry because you got hurt. And so I can't get that empathy hook. So when you talk about the prodigal son and you talk about, at least what I say, is there is no point in time when you can't come home again. You can come back to the congregation, you can come back to your family, but there's certain boundaries, certain guidelines you have to set up. But I'm going to let somebody else do it with the sociopathic person, because it's like bringing a wolf into the sheep's. You know, I'm just not going to do that. I won't recommend that. The narcissistic person is predominantly interested in themselves, either because they're overly secure or underly secure, but you can still get some kind of a hook, and there is the possibility of increasing empathy. The obsessive compulsive person uses sex to lower anxiety, lower stress, to lower pain, to medicate away from pain, and that's why they do it. I worked with just a gem of a guy, a Christian singer, and his pain was he would get so lonely being on the road all the time, and what he had learned, he tried drugs and that didn't work, and what he had learned is that if he'd go pick up somebody and have sex with them, it would take away the loneliness and some of the discomfort that he had, and he addicted to that process. Just a gem of a guy, and a deeply committed Christian guy, and interestingly enough, got into some real cognitive dissonance and got pretty suicidal about how do you put those two together? I'm not supposed to be doing that. But was so compulsive around it, he couldn't alter that. I've known pastors that had the same thing. They could get up, they could preach a great sermon for the other folks, but some of the emptiness in their own life only seemed to be able to be handled if they crossed that line, and instead of, and I don't differentiate a lot, maybe they medicated their pain with drugs, maybe with alcohol, maybe with overwork, maybe with overeating. Yeah, all of those are medicators. The addicted person is somewhat different than the obsessive compulsive in that what happens literally when someone addicts to sex is I'm obviously hitting this too quickly, but it's something like the person who addicts to cocaine or addicts to overeating. And what that is that there's an endorphin release in your head, a chemical endorphin release in your head when you go into the pattern. I work and I concern myself about overeating, but I can be in that anticipatory thought of standing in front of the refrigerator and knowing, and I feel my hand stuck to it, I don't want to open the refrigerator door. I don't want to eat. I'm not hungry. I do. And I know when I open it, I know what's in there, and it's not. But, and standing there and being caught in that dilemma, there's an endorphin release in your head, is chemical, that releases into your body when you're in that anticipatory state, which can also happen around sexual activity, where you get into a ritualized behavior, you go into your counseling mode with your parishioner, and you're doing like this, and your parishioner is telling you all their stories, and then pretty soon you begin telling some of your stories, And then pretty soon you share your pain and how life is painful, it's not working too well for either one of you. And with that endorphin release, you can actually addict to that process. So it's, people have said years ago when they were first fooling with this idea of addiction that, well, no, it's not like alcohol or it's not like overeating because there's no chemical, there's nothing you put in your system, but there is something you release in your system. Imprinted is the last one I put on there, and that's more like something that happens very early, an early sexualized experience with someone, and we don't know for sure. The fellow that does most of the writing about, that I believe in, about pedophiles and folks who have a quote-unquote abnormal primary sexual arousal pattern, it may well be, it's kind of like a road map. You started up here, and this is where you are, and this is where you'd be as a normal adult. And you got sidetracked somewhere, and in the process of sidetracking, there was something or things that happened that involved a lot of shame, which was very intense, that involved either some fear and a highly sexualized behavior. One young man that I worked with, his issue was cross-dressing and exposing. He wasn't a pastor, I'm just trying to make a point. But he was traumatized by a number of things that were going on in his life, and he would stand next to his mother and rub her nightgown, silk nightgown, against his cheek while he sucked his thumb and tried to get comfort, and he imprinted some sexual things around that. So it's a whole line of things, and I just want to make sure that you hear me when I say any of those, the pastor in your church, can and does fit any of those roles. And I hate to tell you that I have over the years and am currently working with a number of clergy on these kinds of issues. And it's painful and it's difficult and it's so crucial to be able to say, particularly to people who come from that orientation, that I love you but I don't trust you. Because if you communicate to the person who's any of these that's working on that you trust them, guess what? They'll manipulate you. So my message is, I love you, but I want you not to trust that process of yours. I think it's pretty scriptural. A lot of pastors say, yeah, it's like love the sinner but not the sin. And I modify that and say in treatment, I love you, but I don't trust you. So what I want you to do is not trust that in yourself. So the pastor who's had difficulty with this, rather than having an external control, what I want him to do is go back to his congregation when I work with him, and we open it up, we get the church council, he sets the boundaries. I will not meet with a female parishioner after 6 o'clock in the evening. The door will always be open, and blah, 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 blah. Set all kinds of boundaries. The reason he sets those boundaries internally rather than externally is because he doesn't trust that process. Because what he may use is that crossing the sexual line to medicate his own pain. And when a person's doing that, let's go back to what I said on the first overhead. I don't excuse that behavior, but it's dangerous behavior. You can get really hurt very, very badly by the person who gets needy enough to cross that line, and you're the recipient of that. And you can get damaged terribly. And I'm sure you know that. That's not anybody's question. So that's a scary thing. It's a difficult thing. And that's what I try to do with that.
Bill, is there any significance to the order that you put those in?
Uh-uh.
With the arrows?
Nope. Just did them to remind myself. Sexual abuse.
Are you a pastor, or what is your background?
No, I'm a therapist, psychology background. Years ago when I was at PLU, I wanted to be a pastor, but I really didn't do well in Greek. And I do work with a lot of folks in the Christian community, speak in a lot of churches and do that.
So you work with the Bellevue Community Service?
Oh, that's a marriage, child, and family practice that we have. Yes, I do.
Is that in Bellevue?
It's in Bellevue. Uh-huh. Sexual abuse always includes power abuse. There's always a power differential. If there's not a power differential, it's not sexual abuse. Now that can get confusing, because if two consenting, age-appropriate people say that they want to be in some kind of sexual involvement together, and it's an even playing field, that's not sexual abuse. Is it really an even playing field? That's what gets to be the issue sometimes. I can't tell you the number of people that I deal with, particularly with pastors, who will say, but I was very clear with her, you know, ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. But it's not the same, because they're in a power position. I did a workshop recently with the Foursquare Church where Doug Murin told me that what he was concerned about was the lawsuits, and they have a lot of volunteers at that church. It's a big church, several thousand people. I met with 180 volunteers, and the reason he was concerned was he wanted me to do this kind of thing because some of the volunteers, proportionally no higher than any other church, I'm not challenging that church, were getting some kind of sexual involvement with people in the congregation. And when they bring the lawsuit, they say, well, that person represented the church. You see, that's a... And the person says, oh, no, no, no. This was just a little something we did on our own. Well, what was your role? Well, a home group. I was the home group leader for a little Bible study. That's a power position. The church gets sued for that. So Doug said, help. Get people to understand that, because sexual abuse is always power imbalance. And one of the rationalizations that you give yourself that, well, this is an age-appropriate consenting thing, is that I'm in no power position. But leading a Bible study home group is a power position to a person who's vulnerable. So anyway, in our society, we are set up to not want to see the problem. I do a lot of workshops in schools, and in schools I constantly hear, we didn't see anything wrong. But you see, you don't. It could ruin somebody's career. You don't want to see things with your pastor or your school teacher or your OBGYN. You just don't want to see anything wrong. We accept, even support, overt power abusive sexualization and everything else. We model double standards in the sexual arena. We arrest men. We don't arrest women for exposure. I don't know, and I've asked several police, I don't know of a woman in Seattle that's been arrested for exposing. Men get arrested for exposing all the time. I went to a Seahawk football game, and a whole group of women were going under the Montlake Cut, and to cheering crowds, they were... going through on their little boats and exposing their breasts. I didn't hear anybody call the police. But if men were exposing, they would have been... See, it's a whole different story. That's crazy. That's crazy, but that's... Boys will be boys. We see movies like... I always like it because I'm older than those folks. You know, I run into that all the time. The tender old movie, Summer of 52 or whatever that 42. Was. 42. I even got my years wrong. But it's a 23-year-old woman and a 15-year-old boy. But we reverse that and we'd be offended. Or we may be offended. But that was just tender. At any rate, in church, I think... we exclude, not include, sexual sins. I don't know about your church, but in my church, and I have numerous talks with the pastor about this, it's like we'll say that all sins are equal in the eyes of God, but the parenthetical phrase that nobody says anything about is except the sex sins. Because we get more uptight about the sex sins. We want to get rid of them. We want to hurt the people that do the sex sins. And I don't want to give the people that do the sex sins any room, but I also don't want to crucify them as if it's any worse than anger or murder or gluttony or sloth. But I think lots of folks that I deal with are more uncomfortable with that. So we often do one of two things when that happens, particularly in the church. Let's look the other way, let's put the blinders on and pretend it didn't happen, or let's absolutely crucify this guy. Let's kill him. Never let him be a pastor again. Take him out and shoot him, castrate him, do something. Well, I think that's a pretty inappropriate kind of response. And I think we can get to a point where we look at setting clear boundaries. It takes a lot of work. We did some work with a church in a nearby city, and the church chose to, they had an associate pastor who offended, he was a youth minister, and he'd also been a Young Life worker, and I was a Young Life guy, and I hated that, you know. He was also a coach, and I used to be a coach, so he hit me on all the corners, but he had offended 13 young women in the congregation. And his program was so successful, it was nationally recognized. I mean, this guy was a dynamic, dynamite youth worker with lots and lots of problems. What the church did, which took 2 years and was really wonderful, was brought us in, had us work with the church as, in an incest situation, as there was an offender, there was a victim, and the church was the non-offending partner, as the mother would be, say, in an incest case where she didn't know about it. Opened it up, had forums, met with everybody in the congregation, spent enormous amounts of time, broke all the secrets, dealt with everything. A lot of fear and trepidation on the pastor's part. At the end of that 2 year period of time, as best he could tell, 6 families had moved away. And 7 had moved in because of what they'd heard, that they were working that openly. So it didn't really hurt the church, but they dealt with that very openly. And we, Sunday evening service in that church, probably once a month for 2 years, was dealing with this issue. What did we do? How do we break the secrets? How do we make it safe for parishioners in our congregation? How do we make all the kind of things? They set some wonderful boundaries, and it took a lot of work. It was a very difficult, painful kind of thing. But will you tell me what time, since I can't read your watch?
It's 4:30. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, will you do this for me for a minute, because I'm going to stay on time. I know you love this, but would you small group for a minute? I get all this. Oh, geez, come on. I just want to come in and hear something. But look, you're stuck. No fear sneaking out. 4, that group, and you got 2. You have to yell, Paul, if you're in a small group. Okay, I want you to spend a couple of minutes doing this. Well, maybe you two would just, if you're going to, or you want to do it or not do it. No, you don't have a choice, because if you don't do it, he won't do it. Okay, here's what I want you to do. A couple of questions, and I want you to do this quickly.
Really do mean quickly.
Talk about a situation that you know of that either happened in your church or that happened in some church that you know about. Briefly, what happened? Was the victim believed or supported? Did the whole church deal with the issue? I'd just like to know that. Did they do that, or did it kind of get hushed up and forgotten about, or ran somebody out of town? And then I'd like you to pick a descriptor on how come the outcome was for you. Just pick a word or two. Were you sad or relieved or angry or betrayed or at peace? Does that make sense? Go. You only got about 5 minutes of the word. Thank you. Well, what a group of folks. I just wanted to give a couple of minutes, 5-6 minutes, of just for some comments. I would like to say that in this short a period of time, what I hope you walked away with was power imbalance is more of a concern than the actual act itself. That the problem is here, it's not out there. You know, it's a lot closer to home than you think. And that there aren't any excuses, but there are some mitigating processes that get people into some behaviors that really are damaging. And the fourth thing is that you can really work with a person and help them to accept a part of them that is the difference from the awful behavior. You know, they can learn themselves to love themselves, but not this part. Those are my keys that I'd like to try to have you be thinking about. How about whatever you want to say, either a question or a comment or anything for the few minutes we got left? Yeah?
I just have a question. Are these people that you're working with, do they stay in the ministry? I mean, or are they...
You know, ma'am, it's such a wide range of what's done. Yes and no. I know a Catholic priest. I didn't work with him. I have worked with some Catholic priests. I know a Catholic priest that I've gotten to be friends with at some national conferences. He offended children, and he works in an inner city homeless project only with adults. But he is back. He was defrocked, and he got frocked again, and he's being a Catholic priest, but he works with no children. And they monitor that very carefully. So it's kind of sometimes yes and sometimes no. I've worked with a psychiatrist who, and they can monitor that more easily than a pastor, but I'm trying to give you the example that you'd have to do something like this. In his case, for a 7-year period of time, every female that he saw as a client, he had to tell that he was under medical disciplinary consideration, that he had on two occasions had sexual contact with his clients, and that every session had to be videotaped to be reviewed by the medical disciplinary board. He did that for 7 years. So, but he's still being a psychiatrist, and so, I mean, there are ways to do that. It's a lot of work, and but yes, some of them do stay in ministry. Anybody else got a question or comment?
Well, something that came up for me in the sharing in our group was that the not dealing with the situation is, in a lot of ways, worse than the acts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
when there's, especially in God's house and in a church or where the Spirit lives, to have an undercurrent of something. What's going on here? This is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Is a big part of the problem.
In the church, we were talking about what I think is just continues to be the problem is the shroud of mystery still. You know, I mean, they don't know the victims, and understandably, but yet that's hard. You know,
it's really
am I talking to somebody now? It's, and you want to comfort them, or you want to. And what did he do? Well, it can't be that bad, or maybe it was. Or it's just that sort of an air of mystery that's always kind of twirling around, and you get back to it. It's just been about a year since we've been involved with this situation.
And the church, the one church that took it all the way, that I was so impressed with, that I worked with. They had once a month a Sunday evening forum/service, which dwindled over the period of time. Everything was open game. Now, some things weren't. I mean, you were pretty careful about some things you said so they wouldn't be damaging to people. But the last meeting that Maureen had down there, I think 3 people showed up and they decided just to quit doing it. I mean, it had, but there was plenty of way to go in and talk and find out, and so it just got to be a non-issue, which is not what I hear. You wonder, well, what's going on? And this has got to be secret breaking. It's got to be right out in the open. I don't know any other way to do it, but I also don't know very many churches that are willing to do that.
If the problem is historic, prior to lots of people being, I mean, 10 years ago,
sure,
in an institution church specifically, and it just, you find out that lots of people left, and oh, that's why people left, you know, and indiscretion of the pastor and that kind of thing. What about the healing now, though? For one thing, the whole congregation's basically changed. There's probably still some ethos there or something going on, but it's certainly not, or probably 80% of the people wouldn't have any clue even who that person was, because so many people just left because of what had happened. What do you do with the walls and the walls and the woodwork know what's going on?
Well, what I do,
you just you know, at that point, that's tough.
What I do, not with the level of success that I would like to have, but what I do is talk to the pastor and say, how are we going to bring this out in the open to the satisfaction of as many people as possible? Can we run a mission thing? Can we do an all-day Saturday workshop? Can we get some folks in? Can we do some education? Some of the things that I just did here for 40 minutes, do we help people understand and say, look, there are some, get in small groups, get people talking, bring it all out and let people get as much information as possible. Now, having said that, I'm not willing to say, oh, this person had this done to them and this person had this done. I wouldn't name names.
But that none of the active participants are there anymore.
You know, I still wouldn't, if you're running with that, I'd go talk to the pastor and say, my gut's telling me something. And is there a way we can talk about this? Is there a way we can... And you might find there are 12 other people that are dealing with what you're dealing with. There may be 300, but somehow when your gut's telling you that, I'd go in and talk to whomever and say, this is bothering me. Is there any way we can work with this and get it out in the open, even though I full well know this, and this? Yeah, because your gut's telling you something.
I've got a question. How do you know none of the participants are there anymore? We don't know that.
Well, that's true. There might be some, but... All the major participants, I mean, anybody who came forward is no longer.
You mean the victims that were involved? And who are you?
The pastor was involved with some other women in the church, and the other women that are identified had left before we ever got there. They just kind of, they left secretly. I mean, it was just like, oh, we don't like the hymnal or something. And then later would divulge why they left, because the pastor now is in another state, another place, another time. And so it's real, you know, it's...
See, I'd love to see the pastor preach about that for a month.
It's like a real undercurrent, because very few people know, but yet they do.
Your pastor can go see the bishop.
It was my husband, by the way.
Oh.
And we've gone through some cleansing, some major cleansing in the congregation with various things, but that particular topic has not been specifically named.